DEF CON 12 is pleased to present the notorious Jason Scott of TextFiles.com, amongst other infamy. He has been working on a documentary about the BBS scene. Anyone here know what a BBS is? Anyone here still use a BBS? All right. Curiosity, what was the... Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Dysfunctional Nielsen family.
Alright. Jason here is going to be talking about, amongst other things, his documentary that documents and chronicles the BBS scene. Anyone here participated in the making of that? Including yourself, Jason. Let's see that hand. There you go. Thank you, sir. Alright. Without further ado, DEF CON 12 presents Jason Scott.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jason Scott. how many people here were involved in it? It's all just a big cast party. Actually, to tell the truth, there are so many people interviewed that, yeah, I just keep bumping into people who are in it. And I'm like, hi, how's the kids and everything? My name's Jason Scott. I run a site called TextFiles.com. That's how most people know me, because it's this site that has BBS-era text files. That site came into being in 1998 when I thought that I would look up whatever happened to my good old dial-up bulletin board system, Sherwood Forest 2, that was my personal favorite. And then, to my great surprise, there was nothing about it. There was not a shrine, there was no information, there was nothing. And then I said, well, at least I'll find out about, you know, what happened with the New York BBSs. And there was nothing about that. And then, of course, BBSs, and there was very little about that. And I thought, uh-oh, doesn't anybody have the complete collection of BIOC Agent 003's Guide to Telecommunications? And no. And, you know, what about the Barney Badass Bitch files? These were important things. And nobody had it. And that's fine. I did. I had them in my basement. And so I went and grabbed these old 5 1/4-inch floppies and put 9,000 text files up, an unfathomably huge number that rates back to my days of youth. And that has grown. I don't know how many text files I have now. I think it's 60,000, but you kind of lose track. All of these are files from generally the bulletin board system era, an era when people had computers hooked up to phone lines that could answer them, that were run by one or two people, where other people could dial them up, leave messages, download files, and get in trouble with their parents. This concept, what ended up happening for me was that, you know, I decided I'd let the files speak for themselves. I put up these files, and people would come and get them. Of course, anytime you put up 2 gigabytes of text, you end up with these unexpected side benefits. For instance, the number one reason why people come to textfiles.com by a factor of 20 is to download ASCII middle fingers. I am the world's best source of ASCII middle fingers.
What about Unicode middle fingers?
I don't even have a good retort for that one. It was welling up inside me, but it was profane. ASCII art middle fingers, far and away, and then come the bombs. But the site's constantly hit by Google. It's used by people to test search engines. People seem to be testing it to see how much of my bandwidth they can take and all of that. At some point, I started to get text files that weren't from BBS era. But the problem is how do you put something about an Apple, how do you put soft docs for wizardry for the Apple II next to something about, you know, how to make the banner ads disappear from your Mindspring account? So I created web.textfiles.com and said, anything after 1995, you go in this section. Suddenly, people started to send me other things, because once people figure out you have a whole collection of old crap, they go, finally, someone can take my old crap away from me. And so they start sending me this. So I have been given these things, often in the dead of night. You know, CDs of old BBSs, DAT tapes of old BBSs, Apple II hard drives of old BBSs, and please do something with this. I have the machine that the Apple II port of Zork Zero was written on. I would call that a dubious honor. So, but they really had to do things to it to make it do it. So, over time, people sent me things that were like text files. You know, and I realized that it was the spirit that I was collecting. It really wasn't the files. It was this concept, this approach to how people lived online in the 80s. 80s are very important. Late 70s, early 80s are important because that's one of the first times that people start to come online. And by people coming online, I don't mean, purely technical folks. Right now, technical folks in a room in a basement somewhere some distance away from here are doing stuff that would make your colon let go. That's what they do. That's the price, that's the benefit to being in that little room, and they create it. And then 100 years from now or 10 years from now, they're like, oh, we have holographic storage. And someone goes, like I did back in whatever. You hear about people, they're now able to transfer the Bible in X number of seconds on this one internet. They're great. That's wonderful. But people couldn't use it. ARPANET existed, of course. Other network approaches existed in the early 70s. But people, you couldn't just go down to the store and buy connectivity. And it was only in the mid-70s when you start having the early adopters, and then suddenly you can go down to the store. You can go down to Sears and buy yourself your G.I. Joe figure and buy your BBS hardware and software and your modem, and anybody could get on. Some people would say that is the great tragedy or the great wonder, because people, it's just a person online. And that's something that happened throughout the 80s. This group of people, oh, you little weasel. These people, didn't have often a computer background and just started living online. And they are the vanguards of what comes later with the internet. Been there, done that, now there's more of it. And so on, and so suddenly there's this massive move to the internet. Well, history, people don't, when people describe history, they're usually trying to, summarize it in a fashion that makes it easy to understand. So when I was interviewed by USA Today about textfiles.com, the person, Janet Kornblum, who is an idiot, could not answer the simple basic questions about this and was trying to write an article on it. She actually called me back and said, what should the opening paragraph be? Finally, after working with her, like trying to make a sculpture using oven mitts, we were able to come up with something. And she called them single-use websites that were geared towards computer users. As people who have used BBSs, you might find that a slightly disjointed approximation of your youth. At some point, I got this project idea in my head. I have all these BBS numbers. Why don't I make, what would be involved if I just took all these numbers and correlated them and just made, here was every BBS there ever was. Just one big-ass list. How big would that list be anyway? Who would be on it? What neat shit would happen? So I started to code it, and I said, this is kind of fun, and wasn't going to do much with it. And within a very short time, I suddenly found that I had 45,000 numbers. And then I got slash-dotted. Slashdot has been good to me. It's okay. And I now have 103,000 numbers. And there are little stories. Even in the most, all I have in it usually is name of the BBS, its phone number, what years it was there, who ran it, what software is on it. As an extra bonus, if somebody writes me and gives me comments, I add them in. Just in that little amount, because you'll get, the Wizard's Castle, the Freaker's Keep, and IDG Internet Services. And you get the little story of this guy's life. One of the things that I didn't expect with having 103,000 BBSs up listed was that it was a honeypot for people to reminisce. Somebody would type their name into a search engine, and there would come up their name next to the BBS they ran when they were 16, when it ran, where it ran from, listed in this pantheon of every BBS in that area code, names that they had not thought about for 10, 15 years, just presented as if it was some historical concept. And people would write to me, somebody understands! I would then be given a book called Let Me Tell You About My BBS. I got many versions of this book. Sometimes it wasn't very well written. Sometimes it was very well written. Sometimes it was astoundingly well written. Sometimes it was very angry. And so I would collect them, and I thought these were great. And I thought, they totally fucked up. Because one of the things is that over time we expect places like Time Life and PBS and Nova Storm and blah and whatever to come along, and they do the story, right? The Time Life Guide to BBSs. But, thank you. Time Life Guide to Hacking. Dun, 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 thank you. You know, so on. The Time Life Guide to Napster. And, you know, you go, okay, great. Historically. Great. Wonderful. And you're done. And I went out and looked for it. And it wasn't there. And I realized it wasn't going to be there. And by the time it was going to be there, a lot of the people who did it would be dead or uninterested. They would go for the experts. They would try to focus on who died or had sex, preferably at the same time, and they would avoid any of the little joys and the little wonders because those don't come out on screen in the same way as someone dying during sex or, you know, having sex after dying or whatever the hell they do. So, you know, you end up with this, you know, like almost like a sketch outline. And I thought, you know, I'll bet you I could do better. I had a film degree 10 years ago that I never used. Why don't I do something about this? So then I started working on this concept, and that became something called the BBS documentary. This gets an, I put up an announcement. I put up, I register bbsdocumentary.com. I start working on it, and then I get slashdotted. It's fun to get slashdotted once. And people started writing. Wow, what a great idea. Everyone remembers. And I got more fucking books. You know, long, big things from people. Wow, it's wonderful. So for 3 months, I researched, said, how am I going to do this? How would I tell this story? What's it going to be about? What's it going to be going on there? Now keep in mind, my first thought was not, where am I going to get funding for this? My first thought wasn't like, oh boy, now I've got to go come up with this spec sheet so I can go run this around to Tech TV and run this over to PBS and maybe somebody will give me some money. Where's Ken Burns' home? I can go sit outside and, you know, try to, my first thought was just, how am I going to, you know, how am I going to get this right? Not where am I going to spend the money. Because over the past 20 years, 30 years of human history, we've been spending quite a lot of time making it so that you can take the world around you, digitize it down, and present it back to you very quickly. It's kind of what we're into. We like that. It's cool. So I wasn't so worried about that. I wanted it to be pretty good. I wanted it to look pretty good. I wanted it to sound pretty good. And I wanted it to be, you know, I knew that there were people I was going to interview that nobody had ever interviewed. So, you know, I did my little part. So I began announcing that I was about to go into production. I had 500 people ask me to interview them. And those were very interesting people. And I began, you know, I had all of my research up because one of the things that occurred to me was that you're going to have to provide your research. Because I'd rather find out that I did it wrong in an email than in the lobby of the theater. So I got a lot of mail. And, you know, and it's interesting on that level because people have very different history ideas. One of the most common things I encountered was that people would think that the way things happened was the way they experienced them, which sounds like an odd statement, but it really isn't. People would buy a modem. Modems were a good example. People would buy their 2400 baud modem. And when they bought it, that's when 2400 baud modems came out. Period. And, of course, you know, there's this massive variance, 5, 10 years, for different people who buy it at different times. They would say, oh, this happened here. The biggest, you know, the number one letter I tend to get that makes parts of me wrinkle is these letters where people say, you can't tell, you can't possibly, you have to use as many adverbs as you can, you can't possibly ever tell the story of the BBS unless you interview this man. You know, you'll never truly tell the story of the St. Louis BBS scene unless you interview these six people. And very quickly, I discovered how big a subject this was, and that instead of just frazzing through it, that I was actually going to try to take an effort. And so I had to start telling people, I'm not doing a movie. I'm doing a movie about skiing, not ski trails. I can't. You've got to do the movie on your favorite ski trail. I can't. Because, I mean, 103,000 BBSs. The best you can do, if you look at it, is try to get examples of things and use them as archetypes, the freaking BBS, the multi-line BBS, the BBS software company, and so on, and try to show these different things. Get a lot of people on film, and as it turned out, I got 200 people on film. Production was supposed to be 1 year, editing 1 year, and then all the, you know, and then something involving a lawn chair and a drink. But it ended up being 3 years of filming, and you know, and I'm not working on the other projects as much as I want to because I'm doing this other major project. And one of the things I discovered very quickly was that doing a story on the BBS is like doing a documentary on the car. The people who want to watch stuff about Henry Ford are not going to care about Rice Boys renting Dodge Neons and fucking with them overnight. But they're both interesting stories. But how do you put those in the same one? Well, if you're like a lot of places, you do for 8 seconds. You give each one 8 seconds and equal time. So I knew at a very quick point that I was going to end up actually doing a mini-series, a multi-series. This causes the number one complaint about my project, which is, who the fuck would want to watch that? And that's one of those things, right? You know, you I can still remember being in the car telling people, oh, I'm going to be this. How long is it going to be? I don't know, maybe 9 hours. And it goes like, not to insult you, Jace, but who the fuck is going to sit there? Because the problem was I kept calling it the BBS documentary. And so people would think it was this one big Stroheim production of like 9 straight hours. You know, the Bladderbuster 9000 was going to come kill them. Now, as it's turned out, it's going to probably, well, okay, it looks like it's going to be something like 5 or 6 hours split off into episodes where different aspects of the BBS that simply don't mesh are being told. Like I said, I had 200 interviews, which yielded 250 hours of footage. This already causes certain people who work in that industry to go, my God. And then from there, it's been an enormous amount of culling, moving things around. I am still in the editing process. However, I went for this talk because, hell, hey, it's DEF CON, Las Vegas. Come on, Las Vegas. But beyond that, it also inspired me to, like, get a little move on because I was going through a lot of interviews and, you know, now I have something. So, with your permission, I'm going to show you something I made for DEF CON. This does not exist anywhere else. Hi, everyone in the hotel rooms. Start your camcorders. Because the quality is so great on that screen. the DEF CON UHF channel. So, what I'm showing you is about 14 or 15 minutes of footage. And already some of you are like, oh. Jesus Christ. Here's what's going on with that. This is again, like I said, this is a set of footage. And what this is these are kind of example passages from each of 6 episodes. And so you can kind of see them. They don't stand on their own. And by that I mean when you know, beginning, the middle, it's not a little story. It's just, you'll see where I'm going. And I tell people, and it's important with projects like this, these projects of love, certain people will watch it and be like, how do you get out of here in a way that's not too embarrassing for me? You know, maybe I could pull the fire alarm. And, you know, that's fine. That's fine. And you know, you have to say, well, who is this for? And people go, oh, is this going to be on PBS? And I'm like, hell no! You know, PBS will do horrible things to it. You know, you look at, I mean, Tech TV is coming to interview me. So I love you, Tech TV, but Tech TV with Nerd Nation, for instance, it's a bunch of remixed documentaries that have been, you know, chewed around, and it's not the way that they intended it. So I always intended this to be a DVD set. So this will probably be a 3-DVD set with a lot of extra footage and everything else. And I'll talk about what I'm going to do with the footage afterwards. But, you know, about, you know, 3 DVDs of these different episodes based around different focused parts of BBSs. I started to put names under everyone, but I realized that was probably just being way too crazy right now with this thing because the faces go by so quickly. People who I interviewed who may or may not have been meaning to you, like I said, of the 200 people, and this is very important, normally when you do a documentary, you go interview the 4 experts, the freak job that best exemplifies the weirdest aspect of what you're doing, and you get some sort of narrator. And I didn't want to do that because BBSs weren't about figures. They were about people. You want to interview people who use them. So I went, and I'd say about a half to three quarters of my interviews are just people. They started a BBS in 86, they ran it till 91, and it went down. And that was their fun. And they speak much more honestly about this than somebody whose professional job is to say, you know, telecommunications are the forefront of the surfing of the blah, AMD tech thing, peer-to-peer. So I wanted people with names, quote-unquote, because it's just great to meet them. You know, I got to meet Tom Jennings, who wrote FidoNet. got to meet Wayne Bell, who wrote World War IV, got to meet Vinton Cerf, got to meet Ward Christensen, who did X-Modem, Chuck Forsberg, who did Z-Modem, Mark Herring, who did Quick Packets, a concept, okay, I'll forgive you that one. Anyone know what Quick Packets are? Quick Packets were this great idea. Oh, see how popular it was. Thanks. So, basically, this guy, Mark Herring, wrote a module onto bulletin board systems that would take all of the messages and put them into a packet that represented those new messages. So when you dialed up with your client onto this thing, it would pull down a block of, here's all the new messages, and then disconnect. And then it would provide them with an offline reader and writer. And you could write all your replies, take all the time you wanted to, and then it would call, and when it came up, bam, up came your 15 messages in full, you know, Technicolor. You know? And even though everything went to crap, that would have revolutionized things. Mark Herring told me about... Woo! The guy who, did Quick Packets told me about sysops who were quadriplegics, who could be on their board and run things and leave messages and not be tying up their own board for hours on end, typing with their mouth. And you'd never know. I dedicate some of these episodes to different people, and there was this quadriplegic sysop. I just thought that was... Anyway, all that said, so a lot of names are going to go by, a lot of faces are going to go by without names and so on. And you get an idea for it. So there you go. It is, once again, it's a logo, 6 little excerpts with filler music, and then a trailer called 200 that I just put up on the website about 2 days ago. There's a trailer on the DEF CON disc called Where's. It's really weird. I just did it for fun, so anyway. It was very important to me not to betray people. It was important not to say, you know... thanks for telling me your true and honest story, but it's about piracy! Because that sucks. So, anyway, you do what you do. Boop, damn you.
We didn't just suddenly wake up one morning and we had the Xbox. We didn't wake up one morning and the internet was there. You know? How did we get there? That's what you want to know about history for.
January 16th, 1978, I went out to go to work and it had been snowing most of the night and I was unable to get out because it just kept snowing and kept snowing, and I lived on an alley which had to be shoveled. They didn't plow it for a long time. So I think I shoveled for like 2 hours and probably came in at like 9:30, 10 o'clock and realized I was not going to work that day. So I called Randy.
I asked Ward, you know, could he write some software that could let people talk to each other?
And I said, you know, I've got the computer club recorder where people can call to find out when the next meeting is and to leave questions and things like that. And why not take that line and put a system on it that people could upload newsletters and things like that?
The whole BBS thing was for our computer club to be able to produce newsletters. That was the whole idea of it. It worked. From wherever it went from then, fine.
I found Ward's system originally, CBBS Chicago, mentioned in an article. If I recall, it was in InfoWorld. And I went, that's cool. And I called it. And played around on it and went, that's really cool.
Within 2 years, there was easily 200 to 300 phone numbers that you could call into the RCPMs, the RBBSs, the CPM net guys. And, you know, we've celebrated 100 calls. It took us almost 3 months to get 100 calls on the bulletin board because nobody had modems. So the only people that were calling bulletin boards were the guys that were running bulletin boards.
We said, we had our own computer. Wow. Everybody's jaw dropped.
All of the software we could get our hands on, we got. We transferred it over the phone lines, and we looked at it, and we learned from it.
Yeah, well, this actually was a custom cabinet a friend built for me. I had all these boxes of floppy disks. Each of these boxes holds 70 disks. Somewhere around here or so, they changed from 360Ks to 1.2 megs. And basically, these disks here, which numbers from 1 to 1800, are all shareware. This is all DOS, very little Windows, almost all DOS shareware that I collected from BBSs. Now, the entire contents here fits on two CDs. I've put it on two CDs.
Well, and that's a question that I think you'll find is not different here than it is everywhere, and that is something has a purity about it that should not be sullied by even accepting money if people want to give it to you. I am a radical free marketeer, and I believe that marketplaces are the best way to tell what has value and what doesn't. Because I think it's a test as an engineer. It's just like putting a meter on something, in my view. Because if you can tell yourself what counts and pretty much make anything sound like it counts. But when other people tell you it counts, they can tell you a couple of ways. They can tell you with words, which are cheap, or they can write checks which say it really does count. And so I'm very much a believer that money doesn't sully anything. It ratifies it.
I guess I vaguely talked of them as the fuzzy people. Now, I don't know why I came up with that term, other than that they tend to have beards, and they tend to vibrate when you were talking to them. They moved a lot, and so I could never focus on them, so I called them the fuzzy people. They didn't know what they wanted. They didn't know how to get that, and they knew somebody else was going to get it first.
You know, there was a period of time that you'd start to see advertisements on TV where they would actually mention at the bottom of their ad their bulletin board system where you could contact them. That was impressive at the time. I mean,
I actually, until you mentioned it, I didn't even remember that there were paid BBSs.
See, it all goes bad when you introduce money. Introduce business.
And I woke up, and I'm just lying in bed, and my eyes opened, and I saw the little light on the hard drive. It was flickering. And it occurred to me, I'm like, it dawned on me, somebody's using this now. This computer's not being wasted. I'm asleep, but someone's using it.
I think it's like running something and seeing people using it and maintaining it and, you know, watching.
You were the king or the queen or whatever of your own little kingdom.
I used to watch people and see exactly what they were doing. I could come home, if there was somebody on my bulletin board, I could turn on my monitor and see exactly what they're seeing and see them doing something.
At the end of the day, it's the sysop that is the ultimate judge, jury, and executioner.
I would put the sysop screen up and start talking to somebody, and if they were nice to me, I gave them special access. And if they weren't nice to me, I would, goodbye, kick them off.
You know, any time there was, the system had gone down or, you know, something strange with a modem or something like that, I felt this great responsibility to take care of it. It's like sort of like a child type thing.
You know, a lot of sysops got this protective feeling about their users, you know, like they were my users. You were over here trying to steal my users, you know. Well, first things this is that, you know, there isn't no such thing as my users, you know? They're fickle. They go where they get the most for their bang, for their buck, or time, or whatever, you know?
I was never into the sysop, co-sysop type crap anyway. I mean, people would, oh, God, I want to be a co-sysop. It's like, I don't need any, number one, I don't need any help. I mean, the system runs itself. And number two, what does a co-sysop do, you know?
Never a sysop, always the co.
When I was in bed, and at night, and it was dark, and the screen was turned off, and I was just lying there, and I could hear the hard drive chirping away, making its little music. I could tell exactly where people were on the board, based on the notes and the sounds that it was making. I could tell what door game they were going into, whether they were reading a message or posting a message, you know, if they were just logging in or if they had just logged out. You know, I could follow their progress through the board just by the sounds the thing made.
Imagine you're limited to creating a picture with 16 colors and only the letters on your keyboard. That's what you're given. You're given this finite, you know, resource of like 80 by 25 or 80 by 23, and you know, you have this many rows of characters, and you have this many lines.
This art concept, this thing that they call ANSI, you know, how do people actually make these? They look impossible to build.
It is incredibly hard to explain to someone the entire concept of a community based around dialing up to another computer, downloading files, art associated with it, scenes, the entire concept of a scene. I mean, these things are so hard to verbalize, to vocalize, to paint this picture of an entire subculture that most people have no idea has ever existed.
A lot of people have forgotten about art groups and about ANCR. And it's a shame. It's some of the most incredible artists and artwork that I've seen have been on computer, ANSI, art, VGA, RIPS.
It was always this battle, like, and it's tough to put in words, but there was this feeling of acid versus ice.
Acid and ice.
Ice questioned it. We were number one. No, you're not number one. Acid is number one. It's always.
Evil.
Acid always won. Ice was always number two, no matter what they ever did.
Yeah, my thought is, one of the clips that you played for me about acid always being a step ahead of ice, I believe this to be totally untrue.
But I mean, really, it is a silly pastime. In a silly medium that has no practical use whatsoever, other than to maybe get yourself, you know, 10 or 15 bucks from someone who will pay for your ANSI or to get your access to wares.
Dude, I got 40 to 50.
Once you've discovered the internet, and even when BBSs were still going strong, you knew that it was the future.
First you drop one phone line, then you drop the other.
It just was becoming a hassle, you know, with three kids.
Ran it until 1994 when we had the big Northridge earthquake, and I think it was a 6.6 earthquake. And of all the things that happened during that horrible earthquake, my computer was up and running and the disk was spinning, and that was not a good thing to have going on during an earthquake, and it crashed.
It came down to I was going to have to spend a fair amount of money at that time to replace the hard drive, and there were just few enough calls that I was just said, no, that's it. Sorry, guys, I'm shutting it off.
And that was like a sad day in my book.
I think the last time I went on a BBS, it was actually a rant going, you guys have to get on the internet.
You know, it's weird. There doesn't seem to be a direct analog to the original BBS scene online today.
There are certainly localized web boards, and there's an immense number of web boards, and actually they are, in spite of the fact that they all suck.
Usenet isn't really like BBSs. You know, mailing lists aren't really like BBSs. None of those things kind of have the same feel.
There's something about dialing up, you know, and getting the busy signal and waiting to get on.
man, I want to be, oh, come on, where do we get off? I want to get online. And
I think the percentage of idiots is the same now as it was back then. But if you have 20,000 people instead of 50 people on a board, you're just going to have that many more idiots.
I just spoke in front of this class at CalArts. It's communications arts or something. I had to explain what a bulletin board message base was. It's like, well, with this program you'd have on your computer, you'd dial a number, and you'd enter your name and password, and it would say hello, and then you could go to the messages, and you could read these messages. And then you could add one. And if you waited long enough, and I had to say months, other people would have called in and left messages, and after a few months, you have a conversation. And they're like, why? You know, they were all in their early 20s, and I was like, well, that's stupid. I mean, you know, it is stupid. It was unbelievably stupid.
Tom Jennings of Quitoman.
Stealing software isn't as personal as it used to be.
No. Getting the game as fast as we possibly could, if that meant overnighting the game from, you know, Datasoft or Broderbund or whatever, we would do that, and then when we'd get it, we'd have it cracked by morning. You know, that was our goal. And then we could post on our bulletin board that we had the game. And that was, if you could do that, you were first to town, you were the king of the hill. That was the whole deal.
Serious competition developed between different groups. These groups would compete with each other, and then with me as an individual, in getting out, you know, these new wares, and who can get it out first. Because ultimately, whoever got it out first, their version and their name, by extension, would be the one that dominated.
The playing of the game, it's a little secondary, unless you're talking about something like Choplifter, which was such a wonderful game.
You didn't care about the game so much anymore. It was more about being first.
Competition.
Yeah.
Classic hacking mentality race.
Yep.
We call it Juarez. So that's why Juarez and Juarez was to like, Tienes Juarez?
Wares. I mean, that was what it was all about back then. I can remember getting Ultima 3 before it was actually in stores from one of the local AE boards.
And it's odd to talk about values when you're talking about pirating software and so on, but there was a code of ethics involved. Nowadays, I think that code has slipped quite a bit, but back in the good old days, if you released a crack and it didn't work, you got a reputation as somebody who was a slacker or whatever. You made every effort to go back out and re-release it and make sure that people got fresh copies and so on.
That was the big reason why bulletin boards existed. Was so people could find out what the new games were and crack them down and hack them down and copy them faster than anybody else. That was the big game. It was a competition to get who could get there first.
Yeah.
You know, whoever could crack it first, you'd have your name up in lights. 20 years later, now we're getting it in lights, but, you know, here's the lights.
Require voice validation for
Well, thank you for getting through that. basically what you're seeing there, like I said, are six episodes. I tried to split them up in along general senses. There's actually a seventh one, but I didn't want to kill you.
Secret door?
No, FidoNet, because I've got all these people from FidoNet. It just worked out that way. I got to be in the living room where FidoNet was created. Hooray. Anyway, so in each of these cases, as you can see, I tried to go for the early days of BBSs when BBSs go out. That's pretty simple. Out, quote unquote, sorry. When you see the HPVAC, that's the one that they would normally only, that would only be the one they're putting up. Right? That's the one they want. But I wanted that particular episode. I don't know if it's quite obvious from that footage, but you'll notice that it really wasn't about coming out to kill people in their homes, and which is like the underlying aspect of most hacker documentaries that are done professionally, is these people are going to come and kill you, come meet your enemy. And this particular one is like, boy, we sure had a whole fun time, and we had our little code and what we wanted to do, and it was really important to us to win against the other guy. Those are members of the Midwest Pirates Guild. That's the Freeze. Let's see, there was a number of other figures who I keep forgetting. The really spastic guy with the two pinball machines is named Jeff Keegan and was one of my best interviews. He just, he basically channeled the 80s in front of me. It was amazing. He was like, I'm feeling it. I can't get online. Ah! So that was really kind of wonderful. BBSs are not dead. That's kind of the important thing to point out. I interviewed a group of Texas area sysops who still meet once every month, who still run all BBSs and still do their thing. BBSs are big in other countries. BBSs are huge in Russia and so on. So it's not like that, but on the other hand, it's not like it was now here because of the internet. So in splitting it apart, I think I'm going to tell a better story. And I'm hoping at the end of it that I've done these people right. With this talk, I've actually cut through. I don't know if I really have time for questions. So let me say what one of the plans that I always intended to do. Let me cover two things. First of all, people are like, well, you're producing DVDs. Are you concerned about pirates? And as I was explaining to the duplication place, I said, you know, of course you understand that Deviance is going to have a release of this while it's in the plane coming to my house. Yeah. So you can spend your life, you know, there's a certain spectrum of people who use media, correct? I mean, you have people who would never think of, if a media thing was for sale, never would think of taking it or, quote, well, not taking it, but you know what I mean, copying it. And then you have people for whom, if they do not get it free, it is a personal insult. And what you'll notice is that companies and people who create content don't know where to draw the line. If they, you know, there are these guys over here, I don't care what you stick in the package or what you do, they're going to take it. And if you treat everyone like they're those people, everyone's miserable. Why are you doing that? So my goal is to come up with reasons why people would want to buy it, and, you know, I may have it that people can send me messages that will be included on the DVDs, you know, things like that, you know. Take a creative aspect to it. Do the best you can, but realize, yeah, of course people are going to copy it. And oh no, more people are going to learn about BBSs. They sure screwed me. So, you know, that's going to be fine. The other thing is, what about all the extra footage? Because one of the things that really pisses me off whenever I see a documentary is they'll have an interesting guy, and I'm like, no, I just want to hear that guy talk for an hour. So, I've already made arrangements with archive.org that basically full interviews are just going to go on there. A year or something after release, where it's like, wow, Ward Christensen, what did he have to say for 5 hours? Which was how long our interview lasted. Well, you're going to get it. I am Ward Christensen's only video interview. The man who made X-Modem only appears on footage I shot. I thought that's wrong. Same with the guy who created Z-Modem. A lot of other people. I wanted these stories so that in another couple of 20 years when they go, wow, you know, BBSs actually did turn out to be important, they can go back and they can just pull up this footage and go, oh, there it is. Well, wonderful. You want to trade for it. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I'm trying to do this right, and doing it right has been a lot of energy. Doing it wrong doesn't take much energy. I could have shot it in a month. But I wanted to do it right. Can you write me a good wrap-up sentence? I'm kidding. basically, what I'm saying is the amount of effort it took on my part to go from there to here was merely wanting to do it and sticking to it and doing it. And there are a lot of people out there who I hear talk about projects, and I have to do it, but I just got to get this, or I need my server to be right, or I haven't gotten the HTML to, I haven't gotten the cascading style sheet to look as good as I'd like it to, so I can't start my programming project. And I'm just like, just start it. Just start it. It'll all work out in the end. There's been a lot of people who have helped me along the way. There have been a lot of people who gave me things. It probably isn't much of a secret, and I certainly won't make it a secret, that there was one person who I interviewed who said, wow, this seems really important. Here's $10,000. Because he saw what I was doing and what I was going about, and he gets a free copy. you gotta do comps, right? You gotta do comps. He goes, take two. But it became by being honest to people. I always told people what I was doing, what I'm doing this about, and I always made sure that when I showed somebody that it was honest, that you weren't, you know, seeing Trekkies. Yes, sir. Where can we get it when it's available, he says. If you go to bbsdocumentary.com, there is a notification list you can sign up for. There's trailers, you can look at photos of the interviews, which I did, and you can sign up for it. And it's not a committance thing, of course. Just go up there and say how many you want, and then my people will come for you. Anyway, I hope that my bulletin board system documentary is the worst one ever made. And that the really good ones will be the ones that go, he did it wrong, we can do better. And they'll start making them. That's really important to me. And, you know, because this is my bag, bulletin board systems. And I'm saying, you know, make your own worst documentary too, if nobody else is. You know, the rewards are quite amazing. Yes?
What's the stand as far as a producer, distributor?
I'm going to distribute it myself. I trust nobody. You know, I mean, in the old days, there were like three networks, and they all hated you, and they wanted your stuff for free. Sometimes they would pay you to make stuff that they would then take from you for free. I went to film school, right? And then I started to learn about how they make films and what's involved in films, and I was like, woo, computers! And, you know, I'm not going to fill up this time with a huge rant, but, you know, the days, for the moment, the days of where you had to get a person to do it are kind of over. You know, I mean, I shot it on video. I shot it $3 an hour on this Canon XL1, this one poor piece of equipment. And, you know, got it as a floor model from B&H Photo. Picked up a couple microphones and shot it myself. Did it on Video Vegas. I have a 1.5 gigahertz machine running Vegas Video with 4.5 terabytes of USB 2 storage. And that's how I've been doing it. And when I'm done, if you have something, I can hold it for you. All set. All set. Boy, it's loud in there. But, you know, there you go. And people are like, what about RAID? Why didn't you do it in micro, you know, on a Apple? Why didn't you do it with it? You know, why didn't you? And I'm just like, I just did it. You know? And if I did it a way that isn't as professional, it still got made. So, I guess that's really about it. Oh, someone's giving me the finger. Oh, two fingers? Joe Way? Finger, two fingers? If you need to ask Yard, I got it for you. Any other question, I guess? What?
When
will it come out? Oh, you scare me. I will not let 2004 pass without it. So, there you go. Yes, sir. One more.
So, is everyone on PBS land white? So, you know, just a couple people. Other than that, is it just this culture?
In America? Yeah. Yeah, primarily white. You know, tried to play the game of like, you know, like, well, I need to get, you know, it worked out to an awful lot of white males from suburban neighborhoods. A few women who wanted to think they were the only women. This is what objectively, I gotta tell you, I went, and a few black guys, and a few Asian guys, and a few, other? You can't, you know, can't make butter out of air, man. I shot the footage that was there, but one thing that did come out of it all was that at the end of the day, for everyone I interviewed, it wasn't about the code, it wasn't about the hardware, it was about the people that they met when they were there, it was the people, the friendships they made, the loves they had and they lost, and that's the glue that stuck around years later. No. No. However, BBS Babies came behind the camera on two occasions and were like, what are you interviewing about? And they said, oh, BBSs, what's that? So, you know, that was kind of, what do you call it? Eh. So, anyway, I interviewed one kid who'd never been on a BBS that wasn't as productive as I hoped. Okay, a man is coming to kill me. All right. Thank you very much, and thank you for your patience. I forgot one other thing. I am now going over to the Electronic Frontier Foundation dunk tank. So if after enjoying my film, you wish to make me wet, just come on over to the Electronic Frontier Foundation dunk tank.
Not so fast, folks. I need everyone out that door.